Welcome to the first in a series of interviews by Context TV. The series will focus on the forthcoming book, The End of the Mega Machine, A Brief History of a Failing Civilization by Fabian Scheidler, which will be out in English translation in September, originally published in German in 2015. This wide-ranging book examines contemporary civilization and its antecedents over a long durée, in this case, over the course of several millennia. The historical and substantive breadth of the book will enable us to speak of the deeper structural changes and transformations that have brought us to the present moment of virtual civilizational collapse, and also to help chart possible alternatives. Fabian Scheidler is the book's author and also the founder of Context TV, which has covered global justice issues for more than 10 years. Our first guest is Vandana Shiva, an Indian scholar and environmental activist and a food sovereignty and seed freedom advocate. She's written over 20 books, including Oneness versus the 1% and Who Really Feeds the World? So to begin, I'd like to invite Fabian to introduce this comprehensive text, The End of the Mega Machine. Why, Fabian, did you take this long historical perspective and explain what the mega machine is?
Yes, thank you for the introduction, Nermeen, and I'm very glad to be here with you and with Vandana Shiva, who has very much influenced my work as well. The book takes a long perspective because the crisis we are in, especially the ecological crisis, is really on a scale that has not been there in all the history of humanity. The industrial civilization has caused the greatest species extinction for the last 65 million years. There were five big species extinction in the 4 billion years history of the planet, and this is a sixth one. So it's beyond human history in a way, and we have created a sort of climate change when we reach certain tipping points, which really puts many ecosystems additionally in danger, and human survival as well. So it's a very deep crisis. We have to also to be aware that we live on a planet where 42 people possess as much as the poorer half of the world's population. So it's an extremely divided population in terms of wealth and income. Now, when we look at the way we have reached this situation, which no other civilization in human history has reached, we have to ask, what are the structures that created this situation? And why is it so hard to change course? I mean, we know about climate change for more than 50 years. The US government had all the information already in the 60s, and there was almost nothing done. And with species extinction and the other crisis, the loss of fertile land, etc., it's the same situation. So my book asks, what are the deep structures that has led us into this situation? And there is a large time frame, which is 5,000 years from the first civilizations, so-called civilizations, that emerged in Mesopotamia 5,000 years ago with the first structures of domination that were created at that time. And the key part, the larger part, is about the last 500 years, because around 500 years ago in Europe, a radically new system has been created, which is based on the endless accumulation of capital. And that means that it has to expand externally. It cannot stop. It cannot exist without growth. And this is, of course, a problem on a finite planet. And when we look deeper at these structures, they are not only economic in nature. I mean, when you look at the economic side, we have 500 big corporations, which are responsible for about 40% of global GDP and of 2/3 of global trade. So these are institutions which only have one aim, which is to accumulate capital and to grow. So these are the key institutions of the economic side. But the state is very much tied to this historically and today. The modern state, which was mainly a military institution in the early modern age, has evolved in a co-evolutionary way with the institutions of capital accumulations. Both were dependent on each other. And we see that today in the fact that many of those 500 corporations could not survive without huge subsidies from the states. That means from the taxpayer. The International Energy Agency says that we are subsidizing the fossil fuel industry with about $300 billion a year. That means the climate crisis, we are subsidizing it. And the International Monetary Fund even says it's $5 trillion every year. And you see that in the current corona crisis, that the aviation industry, the car industry, Wall Street, and all these polluters, they receive huge chunks of money. And so we have to consider the state and the corporations as part of one system. And the third pillar of this system, in fact, of what I call the mega machine, which is a term that was coined by Lewis Mumford 50 years ago. The third pillar is ideological in nature. The main ideological pillar is that we have created in the West a civilization that is superior in every aspect. It has the best religion, which is Christianity. It has the best technology. It has reason. It has a quasi monopoly on reason. And you see that it's a missionary ideology which suggests that the Western civilization is the best we can have and that there's no alternative and that all the world has to become like us. And so that was a way to justify the extremely violent expansion of that system, the colonial expansion, which started even before Columbus, but then after that with all the genocides and the wars that we knew. So these are the three pillars on which the mega machine rests, and it's based on endless growth and endless accumulation.
So Vandana Shiva, if you could, thank you, Fabian, if you could respond in part to what Fabian said, but in particular, just because of the crisis, the immediate crisis we're in the present moment, namely this lethal pandemic and its relationship to some of the crises, in particular, the climate one that Fabian has spoken of right now and also in his book. We're standing now in a moment where the global death toll is approaching a million from COVID-19, the disease caused by the coronavirus, with almost 25 million cases worldwide. And now India, where you are, has the fastest growing infection rate in the world, reporting 75,000 cases a day. Vandana Shiva, if you could elaborate.
Well, first, you know, on the roots of these new pandemics, they're really, once in a century you had a Spanish flu, et cetera. But last 30 years, you've had 300 new infectious diseases, and 30 of them severe, whether it's Ebola or Zika or SARS or now Corona, Nile virus, the list is very long. But the roots are common. The roots are you invade into the homes of other people and other species. You destroy that safe habitat where those viruses are no problem at all. They're safe on animals. They're in balance with the ecosystem and the species and the cultures. And you create what's being called the spillover effect. And suddenly a harmless virus is a pandemic. But this, what is leading to the invasions into ecosystems? Fabian talked about the expansionism. The expansionism is really this limitless growth without any limits of any kind, being at the root of finding new colonies all the time. Otherwise, India has grown all the beautiful pulses and the dals of the world. People want to have protein, just grow nitrogen-fixing crops with your cereal. We will solve two parts of the problem. We will solve the problem of having to grow GMO soya in the Amazon, and we will solve the problem of climate, about which I can talk later. But 90% of the soya being grown in Argentina, in Brazil, even in the Midwest of the United States, is then going to biofuel and animal feed. So did the world suddenly get up and said, okay, now we'll have biofuel. No, it was worked out as a strategy. And in my book, Soil Not Oil, I worked with those who worked in the triple crisis to show that if you try and squeeze diesel out of soybean, you use more fossil fuels than you substitute. It's a negative energy equation. But it has huge subsidies. So if huge pipelines are being laid in the new refineries of biofuel in America, it's because of the subsidies. If animals are being pulled out of the pastures and the grasses and being put into factory farms, it's because of the subsidies. Now, for grain and agriculture, I had worked out when I was dealing with WTO, and it was a big force in the globalization of agriculture. We were already talking about $400 to $700 billion subsidies. But I think if you take all of the biofuel and the animal feed, you add all the other subsidies and then add it to fossil fuels, what you get is most public money is going to create disasters, not just the pandemic. 50% of the greenhouse gas emissions come from a fossil fuel, chemical-based, industrial, globalized agriculture system. And it is creating not just the pandemic, it's creating the chronic diseases. It is creating the extinction crisis, as Fabian mentioned, because, you know, since Hitler's time, as Rachel Carson so powerfully put it in Silent Spring, that chemicals made as agents of chemicals made for chemical warfare as agents of death of man, then after the wars became agents of death of life on earth and became pesticides and then became herbicides, all fossil fuel based. And the extinction crisis is really of this period since fossil fuel based chemicals became the base of agriculture. But the same system is very costly. It's driving peasants off the land, getting them into debt. In my country, 400,000 farmers have committed suicide since globalization. And the pockets can be mad because the National Bureau of Crime Records maintains this data. And organizations like ours work on the ground and you map one-to-one. The more heavily globalized, the more heavily dependent on industrial agriculture, purchase GMO, BT, cotton seeds, purchase chemicals, the more is the debt, the more is the suicide. And hunger, when you stop having food system for feeding the earth and the soil and people, then there's a machine, the mega machine drives your food system and it drives the system to pull food away from the soil, pull food away from other species, pull food away from the children. You know, nearly 800,000 children of India are dying every year because of malnutrition. Totally unnecessary, because my work of the last 35 years has been to do an agriculture that produces lots of food while protecting the earth. So the mega machine is, I have started to use the language increasingly, it is a machine of ecocide. You know, the chemicals were instruments of death. It is an instrument of genocide. And if you start tracing the deaths back through the causal links in a truly scientific way, where you make the links, they come back to the corporations, they come back to the billionaires, they come back to the asset management fund. And when you look at it all, the billionaires own the corporations now. Even in the corporate, East India Company was created as a colonizing force. First corporate, Dutch East India Company, and then the British East India Company. But the Dutch got stuck with Sumatra and Indonesia. The British expanded to 85% of the territories of the world. And if you want to look at corporations, you look at the history of colonialism. If you want to look at billionaires, you look at the history of colonialism. And that's why I'm so grateful that Fabian has done this book with this very long perspective, because we do need the long perspective, particularly the last 500 years.
So, Vandana, before I go back to Fabian, I'd just like to ask a couple of questions from the point of view of what the broader mainstream perspective seems to be in many parts of the world, namely that industrial agriculture is in fact necessitated by the exponential growth in the population worldwide. In fact, that it would be impossible to feed the world without industrial agriculture. And similarly, that population growth, that there are 8 billion people in the world now, almost makes it necessary to encroach on animal environments. So your response to both these things.
So thesis number one, that you must, that there's a growing population. There's no inevitability about the population growth. As I've written in my book, Earth Democracy, whether you look at Scotland, the highland clearances where sheep were put by enclosing the commons, that's when the population grew. In India, the population was totally stable for centuries. India has had amazing statistics maintained. Totally stable population. British takeover in 1757. By the early 19th century, they've changed land tenure laws. And after 1815, the population starts to grow because the peasants' land has been grabbed by them and they've created zamindari and landlordism. And the dispossessed peasants now have to struggle to make a living. And there's a brilliant book by Mehmed Mahmood Mamdani on population, has a quote where Mahmood asks peasants in Punjab, why do you have so many kids? And he says, well, the landlord can get his next tractor. I can just have my next child. And in my 50 years of grassroots research and work, I've seen that as the water crisis grows and a woman can't walk further for water, she has more children, so two can help her for the water. In the city where people are treated like throwaway disposable people, people have more kids. So one kid might polish someone's shoes. One kid might go and clear someone's windscreen. So when you take people's security in land away from them through contemporary enclosures of the commons, about which Fabian has written, and you treat them like throwaway people, they literally have just this body to sell, in a very precarious condition. So A, population growth is not inevitable. Second, it is a result of a very unjust system, colonialism very much. But second, what industrial agriculture is producing is not food. It is producing commodities. I gave the example of GMO soya. GMO soya, GMO corn, 90% goes for biofuel and animal feed. It's not feeding the world. That's why you have a billion people hungry. And that's why with the corona lockdown, 250 million are going to get added to this. And even in America, 30 million have no food just now because they've lost their petty jobs, they've lost their precarious work, and the food system is collapsing in America, totally collapsing. Same is the case for England. So I have spent the last 36 years looking at the fiction of producing more food. It hangs on one indicator. The indicator is yield per acre. We grow more yield per acre. So I went into this. I'm trained in science. I'm trained in philosophy of physics. I said, okay, let's deconstruct this thing, yield per acre. What does it tell you? Does it tell you the state of the land? Does it tell you the state of the farmer? Does it tell you the quality of the food? Does it tell you the cost of production? Does it tell you it used 10 units of input to produce one unit of food? No. All it tells you is the weight of a commodity that leaves the farm. Commodity. It doesn't tell you the quality of that commodity. It doesn't tell you whether it's going to make you sick with pesticide residues. And a new study had just shown that 1 week of eating organic reduced glyphosate levels in the body by 70% 1 week. So you can imagine the impact of pesticides and the impact of organic on our health and our body. So I said, if this is not telling me anything about the food system, and my eyes could tell me that our farms up in the Himalaya, where I come from, produce abundant food of 12 crops and 9 crops. Navdanya, the movement I started, means 9 seeds and 9 crops. And I said, I can see in my eyes that this is more productive. I can see with my eyes that chemical monoculture is very pathetic biologically. So I'm going to now measure. So I evolved an indicator called biodiversity-based productivity. And then I translated that into nutrition per acre instead of yield per acre. we can feed 2 times India's current population using the same amount of land. So it is just not true that industrial agriculture is the only way to feed the world. It is the only way to starve the world, to make the world sick, to destroy the planet. 80% of the food we eat, according to FAO, comes from small farms. Only 20% comes from industrial farms. So it is time to lay aside the myth that industrial agriculture that destroys the forest, destroys the climate, pushes species to extinction, gives us chronic diseases, creates pandemics, is necessary for us. It is the root of the crisis. It is the mega machine. In the food system, the mega machine is the industrial food system.
Well, for Fabian, if you could respond, I mean, Vandana has raised a number of points, starting from the pandemic to food security, and also the entire, much of the conversation framed in the context of economic inequality, which, of course, you focus on at great length in the book. So go ahead.
Yeah, I think Vandana is absolutely right that most of the epidemics and pandemics that we saw in the last 40 or 50 years are caused by economic expansion and by the destruction of natural habitats of many species like birds, etc. And so they come into human settlements and we get those viruses. And so in order to stop pandemics, we should stop the economic expansion, but which is impossible, of course, in the frame of this system. Regarding agriculture, I mean, we lose, due to industrial agriculture, 1% of fertile land each year. The UN even says that we have 60 years of harvests left if we go on like that. And this is even optimistic because climate change is not really considered in this. And we also have to be clear that the UN Special Rapporteur on the Right to Food says that we have to switch to organic agriculture, peasant agriculture, if we want to feed humanity while maintaining the planet. And I mean, we cannot feed humanity if the planet goes bust. So we have to switch this. And Vandana is absolutely right that all these statistics about how productive industrial agriculture is does not consider at all the long-term effects. Also, water depletion is very serious. I mean, in parts of the United States, also the Ogallala aquifer is being depleted. And we don't know completely how much time we have left, but it might be 20 years or so. And if the Ogallala aquifer is empty, it takes thousands of years to replenish, the agriculture is finished and you will have a food crisis in the US, which is very severe. So I think switching to a different kind of agriculture is absolutely key to human survival. And regarding inequality, I mean, we have this enormous inequality today, which is about as bad as 100 years ago before the 1929 crisis. And the thing is that for an ecological transition, it is very hard to do that when you have this kind of inequality, because 20% of the global population are consuming 80% of the resources and are responsible for 80% of greenhouse gas emissions. So those 20% have to get down. We have to make sure that their overconsumption, their overproduction is going down. And when we start to think about exiting this growth paradigm and the paradigm of capital accumulation, we have to think about how to take this overconsumption and overproduction from those upper 20%. The poorest half of the population cannot consume less. They have too little. And so the ecological question basically is a question of justice, of climate justice and of economic justice.
Oh, Fabian, also, if I could ask you just to elaborate a little bit more on this question of inequality and in the context of the fact that your book takes such a long view. I mean, it's not just about, as people speak generally, about the post-war order, the order that emerged following the end of the Second World War. Your book takes a much longer view, and you know, many on the left point to the present neoliberal economic order as the most obvious cause for both inequality and the climate crises. So the argument being that the neoliberal economic order is the thing that needs to be changed and thereby changing both these crises. But you say, which is an effect of the fact that your book covers such a long period, that neoliberalism, and I'm quoting here, that neoliberalism is only the most recent phase of a much older system that from its inception roughly 500 years ago was founded on predatory exploitation. So could you explain, Fabian, what you mean by that?
Yeah, I mean, there is a systemic constant in the system for the last 500 years. It was very successful for a minority of the world's population in terms of material wealth. It made like 20 or 30% of the world's population more wealthy, mostly white people in the global north, but some elites also in the global south. But it needs about two-thirds of the population on the planet to be poor because they have to provide all the raw materials and cheap labor for us to consume all this. If we would pay somebody in, say, Congo, in a coal tine mine, wages like in Germany, we could not afford all the smartphones and all the TV sets and everything like that because the raw materials would be much more expensive. So all this machine of growth, of consumption, of production would not work if we didn't get these cheap materials and this cheap labor. And there were different methods in the course of this system that were employed to make sure that these people stay poor. First of all, it was just brutal colonialism from the times of Columbus and so on. It was slavery, but it was also other kinds of forced labor. And it was the military, of course, as Vandana said, the first corporations, the Dutch East India Company, the British East India Company, and so on, they had their own military. They subdued the countries. They exploited by the military. So it was just brute military force for about 450 years. After World War II, a lot of countries, after long struggles for in India, for example, for more than 50 years, reached independence. And so the elites in the North had to react, and they employed new methods to make sure that the people in the global South basically stayed poor to provide cheap labor and raw materials. The first method was regime change. You can see that from beginning in Iran, in even earlier, but in Iran it's very well known in 1953, democratically elected government under Mossadegh was, there was a coup d'etat orchestrated by CIA, British intelligence and so on, because he wanted to use natural resources, basically oil, for their own development in Iran. So we have all the problems we have in Iran were can be traced back to this event. The same was true in 1954 with Guatemala, also a democratically elected government. It was pushed away by the CIA. And in 1960, it was extremely brutal in Congo. I mean, the Congolese had 100 years of Belgian colonization with about 10 million dead due to the Belgian rule. We never will know the exact figures. It was one of the biggest genocides in human history. So they had the first democratically elected president, which was Patrice Lumumba, and he wanted to use the resources, especially copper, for their own development. And that was unacceptable for the copper companies in Belgium, in France, in the United States, and so on. And basically, they orchestrated the murder of Patrice Lumumba, and they installed Mobutu with the devastating effects that we have seen for half a century in the Congo. And you can go on and on and on. I mean, Indonesia in 1965, Chile in 1973. So this is regime change. They, as soon as a government in the global south tries to ensure its own development, even in capitalist terms, it is not acceptable. It will be killed. There were some exceptions. Cuba managed to get away. Then the next phase was the debt crisis in the 70s and early 80s. Many countries in the global south were indebted. And in the early 80s, there was a Volcker shock. I mean, the interest rates went up very high. many countries in the Global South couldn't pay their debt. And then the International Monetary Fund came by and said, well, we can give you new credit to pay your old debt on several conditions. You have to privatize your economy. You have to deregulate your economy. And basically, you have to grow cash crop. This refers to agriculture as well, for the global market. And when you tell everyone and when you force everyone to produce cash crops for the global markets, the prices will go down. And this happened. And this was part of the strategy to make sure that these countries stay poor, that we get raw materials very cheap and so on.
But then if you could respond to what Fabian said, and in particular, the focus on this, the enduring effects of colonialism and neocolonialism. I mean, South Asia, India, it's kind of a microcosm for the crises that are confronting the broader, as Fabian points out, global civilization, from inequality to climate, the mass extinction that you also spoke of earlier. And I just want to cite this one figure, and India is by no means an exception. It's really the norm the world over. The recent Oxfam report, which found that India's the wealth of India's richest 1% is four times more than the total held by 70% of the poorest of India's population. So again, the enduring effects of colonialism and neocolonialism in creating these twin or multiple crises.
You know, GATT, World Bank, IMF were all born in 44 when they realized countries like India was seeking freedom, and it was unstoppable. 1942, we had declared quit India to the British. And at that time, we weren't a divided subcontinent. We were one. There was no Pakistan. There was no Bangladesh. We were one. There's so much evidence to show how the British created, manufactured conflicts and chose the axis of religion. I've also done a freedom march, 1857. The first freedom movement in India, Meerut. And when you look at the memorial of the people who died, half of them are Muslim and half of them are Hindus. Together they fought for freedom of India against the East India Company. After 1857, the East India Company didn't exist, and then it became the British Crown. So not only was there a divide and rule policy put in place to dismember our subcontinent, but it has allowed that axis of hate to get deeper and deeper and deeper. On the issue of free trade, I went into the records and I found out that actually WTO was not the first free trade agreement. Farooq Sheer Farman, Right Honorable East India Company with Farooq Sheer, who had usurped the Mughal emperor. Yeah, he was an illegitimate Mughal emperor, but the last in a declining empire. And they got, I think they paid a bribe of 50 rupees to a clerk in that empire to get a free trade agreement, to have military protection, to have zero taxes, and everything else that we see. So in effect, the free trade agreements of today, whether it's WTO or Trans-Pacific Partnership or all of the new agreements, are about this asymmetric colonial relationship that is designed to extract from the colonies. And as Rhodes said it so clearly when he colonized Rhodesia, which is now Zimbabwe, we have to colonize, not only because we are desperate in Europe. You know, in the early stages, the expansionism came from poverty, the desperation. They said, we get land and resources, we get cheap labor, and then because we finish the economy, we get a market to sell. This is exactly the process. So when the GATT started in 91, and we started a fight against globalization, and we started a new freedom movement, we call it recolonization. Today's globalization is recolonization. So neoliberalism is merely the coming back of naked colonialism. It is the coming back of the robber baron age that led to the crisis of the Great Depression. And then everything else that happened after that. So it is really a return to the worst. And the deregulation is a very, very big part of it. And that's why people like Steve Bannon and all are put in place to tear down institutions as if they are bringing down the elite. institutions that defend democratic rights of people, the rights of workers, our common environment, the climate treaty, the species treaty, the biodiversity agreement, these are for the common good. They are not for an elite. In fact, the elite of that time resisted it, and the upcoming elite is resisting it. What, you know, my book, Oneness versus 1%, and now I'm doing a new report on Gates. Not only is the appropriation of the resources of the people, if you look at the lockdown, the billionaires who were already too rich for their good made money. Amazon walked away with $64 billion additional by shutting down local shops. And the lockdown made them richer, but they're looking for a permanent lockdown of normal economies of normal people. And they really want a digital empire. And that's what our new report is going to be about, a new digital dictatorship, which is a return of colonialism, because it is carving out new colonies. And it's not that the old colonies are going, they're still grabbing land. They're grabbing the seeds. I began Navdanya to save seeds. They're grabbing seeds. Gates has taken hold of all the seeds of the world because he's taken hold of the public institutions of the world. And most people don't realize that public systems are being hijacked by a group of billionaires in the name of philanthropy. So every period of colonialism has needed a new civilizing mission. It was, the excuse was religion and civilizing the barbarians. Then it became development and bringing development to the underdeveloped people, and, you know, Wolfgang Sachs and the development dictionary in which I contributed was all about bringing us pesticides and bringing us big dams and bringing us deforestation to develop us. And then it was about neoliberalism, which was a return to colonization. And right now, as the world is locked down with the coronavirus, the new civilizing vision is our tools of conquest, rent collection, and surveillance. And this is where a lot of people should be putting their attention right now.
Well, Fabian, you know, before we have about 5 minutes left for the show, I wanted to end with asking you, the book, The End of the Mega Machine, your book out next month, that is towards the end of September, The End of the Mega Machine, A Brief History of a Failing Civilization. Towards the end of the book, you gesture at possible ways to withdraw from the mega machine, writing about a, so to speak, exit from below. So could you explain what such an exit would look like? And what are the new ways of self-organization, as you say, that you see coming into being and that might in the future become more possible?
Well, first of all, I think what we see is that the civilization which started 500 years ago has run into deep trouble. I mean, it was deep trouble for most of the world population for 500 years with all the genocides and wars and colonization. But now the system itself gets serious problems. One is that on a limited planet, you cannot grow eternally. So if you destroy the life supporting ecosystems, you will go down sooner or later, because every economy, every society can only be a subsystem of planet Earth, of the life supporting systems. And if you destroy your water supply, if you destroy the atmosphere, if you destroy all the forests, I mean, you will go down one time or later. And it's strange that many people think that capitalism is eternal. No social system can be eternal. Every social system starts, emerges at one point, evolves, and then there are contradictions and it will finish. We don't know when this will be the case. I'm not predicting capitalism will finish at this or that stage, but the crisis is so deep that it's hard to imagine that after this century, there will be still the same type of growing system on the planet. But that does not mean that the systems that will follow, if we have a future, I mean, we can have an extinction of the human species and then everything is finished. But if we survive, there can be all kinds of different systems. There can be even systems which are worse than capitalism. Capitalism has not been the only system of domination, and there can be other systems, and there can be even worse systems. So there is no guarantee that we will get anything better. So it all depends on social movements. And I think we have to be clear that we are in a phase of transition which can take decades. And there is no linear way, as maybe Lenin and other people in the Russian Revolution thought, that we can draw a new system on a map and then to get rid of the old system and put in the new system. It's a nonlinear process. It's a chaotic process, many different interests. And it's like nature itself, it's nonlinear. But social movements can play a very important part. Because when we have a crisis, there are bifurcations. We can go in this direction or in another direction. In the corona crisis, for example, there would have been the possibility to put all this money not into Boeing and the car industry and Wall Street, but into a social and ecological transition, into organic farming. We have talked about subsidies. I mean, these are huge numbers. The state is the main actor that is keeping these corporations, which are devastating the planet, alive. Theoretically, it's a population, by voting or other means, that can decide about where the money goes. So we should use a crisis to counter the state giving the money to the corporations and to give it instead to other institutions and to create new institutions. I think the basic thing in the long term is that we need new institutions. The economic institutions that were created 500 years ago, 400 years ago, like the joint stock companies, they are not compatible with the future of the planet because they depend on eternal growth. We need economic institutions which are made for people's needs and not for accumulating money. There are such institutions. Usually they are small or middle sized because the state is always supporting the big ones. But the state could support those decentralized institutions, economic institutions, which work for the common good. And there are many proposals to do this. But we have to be aware that this will be a hard process, and there will be accelerating crisis, I think, because the climate crisis will really put the livelihoods of many people at stake. And it all depends on the way we can organize solidarity as well, with people who have to flee from their flooded territories, with people who cannot live in their countries devastated by droughts and so on. We have to make sure, and I think Europe and the US has a particular responsibility for this because we are responsible for the greenhouse gases, for most parts of it, to make sure that refugees from these regions can reach territory where they can live and to make sure that there is a decent livelihood for them. So this is also a part of global change, that we organize solidarity on a planetary scale. We don't know if this will be possible, but you know, there are huge movements at the moment, which are in a way overshadowed by COVID-19 now, but there is a huge climate movement. I think we'll research when this virus crisis is over. And I think it's about the convergence of different movements, Black Lives Matter, the anti-colonial movements, the climate movements, the social justice movements. We saw some of that in the US with the Bernie Sanders campaign. Mm-hmm. I mean, the candidate has collapsed, but maybe the convergence process will go on and in other parts of the world as well.
And Vandana, what about your sense of how one can escape or at least mitigate the effects of these the crises that we've been talking about? You've written about moving from extractive to circular economies, and we'll end with you.
Yeah. So first of all, we know if things continue as now, and when this I say things continue as now, under this inequality, under this undemocratic power, under this violation of the limits of the planet, it could be with new technologies, but if that logic stays, then collapse is inevitable. Therefore, the movements from the grassroots, the self-organizing capacity, the diversity, rising, both as an organizing principle in nature as well as an organizing principle in society. And a shift from colonialism, which is extraction. Even the digital economy is based on extraction of rents from software, from our minds. It's based on data mining. I mean, Facebook's entire empire is based on mining your private data and then selling it to advertisers for political hate on the one hand and for money making on the other. So pushing products, behavioral science, as they call it. This extractive system is what's ruining the planet, and it's what's leaving people in poverty. And it's also extracting power from people and therefore eroding the foundations of democracy. So when I talk of circular economy, I'm talking about not the nonsense of a globalized economy of huge waste, recycling waste as the next business opportunity, which is how they give awards to themselves, but the recycling of carbon at the smallest level, the recycling of water, and then these cycles keep growing. Self-organized circular economies and circular democracies of participation, that is where living democracy grows. And learning from nature on how nature maintains the cycles to build economies that mimic nature, which is exactly how we create economies that are subsidiaries of the ecological system and the biosphere. This is what people are doing all over the world. And I think there's a new resonance taking place, even though from the top there is propaganda of a scale. I can't believe the latest propaganda, where an Impossible Burger linked to Bill Gates, 14 patents, GM soya, and fake blood made in the lab. They're saying, oh, it's good for the climate. Lab milk, breast milk, substituting women's breast milk, good for the climate. Bill Gates thinks he can make an excuse to be the answer to poverty, to hunger, to climate, to everything, and make the next buck. For me, circular economies and self-organization and diversity are the principle of the bottom-up process, and it creates a possibility. It doesn't create a certainty, but in a time where collapse is predictable, creating an uncertainty of collapse is the highest hope that we can create.
Well, with that, I think we're out of time. Thank you so much, Dr. Vandana Shiva, and also Fabian, for this discussion on the end of the mega machine, a brief history of a failing civilization. We will continue our series with Dr. Noam Chomsky towards the end of the month.